Thank you, Betty. I always am a little bit uncertain when people announce that I'm an expert on anything. An expert, as you know, is an ordinary person away from home. Or another definition is someone who has his ignorance well organized. Taoism actually has two branches. Most of us are familiar with one of the branches, but less aware of the other. And I just want to mention in passing that there is a section of Taoism called religious Taoism, Dao Qiao. And its basic text is the Dao Tsang, which is actually, I think, mentioned by Madame Blavatsky in her magnum opus, The Secret Doctrine. She calls it by a slightly different name, but then she didn't know Chinese. And so it's possible that she was just trying to imitate the sound. Of these 1,120 volumes, almost nothing has been translated for two reasons. It's an enormous undertaking, and most of it's unintelligible, even in Chinese. It seems to be either written in an esoteric language or, more likely, I suspect, is the result of mediumistic utterances. And if you have ever looked at mediumistic material, you realize a lot of it is gibberish. But people like that sort of thing. It seems to me that from looking at it, it superficially, whatever I can get at, it seems to be a branch of Chinese alchemy. Now, alchemy has a kind of a peculiar reputation. It seems to me to be an esoteric doctrine talking about various different aspects of the human nature. And if you look at Chinese alchemy, it seems to be using metaphors. One of the characteristics is that it uses mercurous sulfide. Now, mercurous sulfide is made up of mercury and sulfur. Sulfur is yellow. Mercury, if you know Western alchemy, was the god who carried the caduceus in his hand. It's quicksilver, right? And the caduceus is a representation of that mystic force called kundalini in Sanskrit. Kundalini in Sanskrit simply means serpentine. That's all it means, translated. It seems to be a mystic force that has three paths, one straight up and the others winding around. And when this force raises from the base of the spine to the head, it opens one up to paranormal vision, immortality. A number of different things are claimed of it. I have to guess because I don't have it. That is to say, rousing the kundalini. But if you look at the metaphors in Chinese alchemy, it would seem that this is the basis of it. It's hidden beneath things. Also, there are meditative exercises, and there are certain dietary restrictions. I didn't put that down. Divination becomes a very important part of it in later religious Taoism. And transmediumship is an important part of it. Also, paranormal healing. When I visited Hong Kong, I went to a Taoist temple. It's very difficult to breathe in that temple because it was filled with incense and had incense pots all over the place. I pay my respects to every deity that I can just in case. And so I went to the Taoist image there and paid my respects. But more importantly for historians, it got involved in socio-political movements. There were a number of these, one of which was known as the White Lotus Society. We in the Theosophical Society sometimes use the image of the White Lotus to refer to Madame Blavatsky, one of the co-founders of the society, and we have a special commemorative ceremony, White Lotus Day. But this was a very different thing. They were reform movements, and the central government was threatened by these and sought desperately to stamp them out. Some of them were fairly successful for a couple of years, but none of them managed to take over the government. What I want to talk about, however, tonight is not that. I've just told you everything I know about it anyway. But about the philosophical Taoism, Dao Jia. Now, this is supposed to have been promulgated by somebody called Lao Tzu. Lao simply means old, and Tzu is an honorific in Chinese. It's sometimes translated old fellow or old boy, but that's demeaning. It's sometimes old philosopher. Perhaps that would be a, well, I mean, as a philosopher, I like that idea myself. But it's an honorific of sorts. But who was Lao Tzu? We don't know. My guess is that these two schools ultimately were one. This is just a guess. And that Lao Tzu was somebody that in the theosophical movement we would call a master of the wisdom. And his doctrine was ancient wisdom. Lao, old, ancient. So he is supposed to be an elder contemporary of Confucius, but the stories about him are contradictory. All kinds of funny things said about him. He's also known by the name as Lao Tan, old lobes. See, long earlobes, I've got them, was an indication of wisdom, of spiritual aristocracy in ancient times. That's why Buddha is often depicted with long earlobes. We have the texts somewhat corrupt by Chuang Tzu, who is 4th century. And Chuang Tzu is absolutely delightful. He's all full of wit and self-contradiction and interesting things and sounds sometimes like Zen, which comes from a different tradition. Another one after him is Lietzi, who is less well-known, but if you don't know Lietzi, you ought to try to find some of his writings. He is absolutely delightful. The Tao Te Ching, the copy that we have, can be dated between 286 and 240 before the Common Era, BCE, before the Common Era. And the reason we know this is because of certain references in it. For instance, the names of emperors, when they were deceased, were verboten. And certain Chinese characters that were pronounced the way the emperor's name would have been pronounced, therefore couldn't be used in the text. So by looking at earlier versions of the text and later versions of the text, we can get a pretty good idea when a particular text was written down. That doesn't mean that's when it was originated. That's when it was written down. And we have two manuscripts that date from about this period. They come from a tomb in a village called Ma Wang Dui. And they're written on silk, which deteriorates. And so there are large gaps in the text. But the text that we usually use and that I'm going to use is the one that was compiled by Wang Bi, a Taoist very many centuries later. A lot of corruptions could have crept in. A lot of rearrangement of the text could have happened. I don't know. The Tao Te Ching, which I'm going to base my talk mainly on, is one of two books that has been translated frequently into English. In fact, it's the second most frequently translated into English of any book in the world. Can you guess which is the first? The Bhagavad Gita. No, the Bible has been translated into more languages than any other book. But the Bhagavad Gita has been translated into English more than any other. And the second is the Tao Te Ching. And the reason for this is the Tao Te Ching is written very cryptically. So anything I say is probably wrong. I'm going to say it anyway. And it has gotten so many translations partly because I think each person who looked at the text said, I know what it really means. Yeah, right. So we have problems with the Tao Te Ching. And one of the problems is that it is not like any other Chinese work. It has no proper names. Confucius is full of proper names. It is written in poetry, rhymed Chinese characters. No other ancient Chinese text is written that way. One would assume that if it had a single author, there should be unity of thought behind it, right? But it's written in such a way that it's very difficult to discern this. Yet, it sounds like it is an ancient wisdom. Chapter 70, My words are easy to understand and easy to practice, yet none in the world can understand or practice them. My words have an ancestry, my deeds have a Lord. Because men do not understand this, they do not understand me. Few people understand me, but upon that my value depends. Therefore, all the text has all of these therefores, and you look at the therefore, you say, this is a non sequitur. There's no non sequiturs. It's absolutely logical. Therefore, the sage wears a coarse cloth and carries jade within his bosom. You say, what does that mean? Ancient China was not altogether a peaceful place. And when rich people went from one place to another, they dressed as peasants and carried their valuables underneath coarse cloth. So this is a metaphor saying you've got to look underneath the words to find the real meaning. But what does it mean when it says, my words have an ancestry, my deeds have a Lord? Arthur Whaley, whose translation I've consulted, Whaley was a noted Confucian. His translation is, I think, sometimes wrong. Sorry, Arthur. He comments, to have neither ancestors nor a lord was to be a wild man, a savage. So this is a metaphorical way, he says, of saying that all the sage did and said was related to a definite system of thought. I will try to suggest that this is a path according to Lao Tzu. The occult doctrine is that Lao Tzu is the author of the Tao Te Ching. And in a book by Leadbeater and Besant, which purports to be based on clairvoyant investigation of past lives of people called The Lies of Alcyone, Alcyone was the star name that was given for Krishnamurti. I mean, he couldn't call him Krishnamurti in his past lives because he wasn't named that. So they chose names of stars for the entities. According to this, they said that he was dated 604 before the Common Era. A myth has him conceived at the age of 62 or 81 years before his birth. That's a very long pregnancy. I'm sure that women will suffer sympathetically with that. When his mother admired a falling star, this has similarities to some of the metaphors or myths about the birth of Buddha. Thus, he was able to speak from birth and had white hair, from which he got his name Lao, old, Tzu, boy, or philosopher. Others have him Lao Dan, as I said, because he had long earlobes. Nothing is said in Chinese history about his youth, but according to Sima Qian, a great historian of the early first century before the Common Era, a long time after his supposed birth, he was, in his later life, the keeper of archives for the court of Zhou. And he's said to have departed from this position at the age of 160, or 200, and he headed west, never to be heard of again. But before going through the Hangu Pass, west of the Zhou capital of Luoyang, the keeper of the pass, Yin Qi, who had expected a sage because of the state of the weather, asked him to compose a book, whereupon Lao Tzu wrote the book we have, called the Tao Te Ching. And if he disappeared, how did they know how long he lived? There's some problems with this. And Sima Qian, in fact, says that he doesn't know what the truth is. There's a story that Confucius visited Lao Tzu in 517 BCE to ask about Li. Li is usually translated ritual or rite, but it's ritual involving the ceremonies of the state all the way down to what we would call etiquette. The whole range is under the title Li. And he came away befuddled, saying to his disciples, I understand how birds can fly, how fishes can swim, and how four-footed beasts can run. Those that run can be snared. Those that swim can be caught with a hook and line. Those that fly may be shot with an arrow. But when it comes to the dragon, I am unable to conceive how it can soar into the sky, riding upon the wind and the clouds. Today I have seen Lao Tzu, and can only liken him to a dragon. All this is extremely unreliable, and probably an imaginative jumbling of a number of different people's lives. Even if you look at Sima Qian, it's fairly obvious he's mixed together a bunch of lives, he even says so. Now, ancient China was a time of decline. The Zhou dynasty had lost control of a large portion of the country. And the Tao Te Ching seems to refer to this, which seems to suggest that it was written sometime in the decline of the Zhou dynasty. Chapter 53, the last half. The court is arrayed in splendor while the fields are full of weeds and the granaries are bare. Elegant clothes are worn, sharp swords are carried, food and drink are enjoyed beyond limit. Wealth and treasures are accumulated in excess. This is robbery and extravagance. This is certainly not Tao, certainly not the way. This led to suffering for the peasant. Chapter 75 speaks to that. Why are the people suffering? Because the ruler eats too much tax grain. They taxed in kind in those days. Therefore, they're starving. Why are the people difficult to govern? Because the rulers interfere too much. Therefore, they're difficult to govern. Why do people take death lightly? Because the ruler strives for life too vigorously. Therefore, they take death lightly. It is only those who do not seek after life that excel in making life valuable. That's one that you have to meditate on for a while, isn't it? Just like Confucius, like all of the other ancient Chinese philosophers, the Tao Te Ching, or Lao Tzu, offers a way, a Tao, out of this. But unlike Confucius, Lao Tzu's way is a radical departure from our ordinary way of thinking and is written in a manner that makes comprehending it difficult, despite his disclaimer to the opposite. Indeed, he seems to welcome our confusion. Chapter 41. When the wise student hears of the Tao, the way, he diligently practices it. When the average student hears of the way, he sometimes believes it, sometimes disbelieves it. When the foolish student hears of the way, he laughs out loud. If he did not laugh at it, it wouldn't be the Tao, the way. Therefore, there is the established saying, the Tao that is bright seems to be dull. The Tao that leads forward seems to lead backward. The Tao that is level seems uneven. Highest virtue, De, seems like a valley. Great purity seems unclean. Ample virtue, De, seems inadequate. Strong virtue seems frail. Real virtue seems unreal. True substance seems to be changeable. The great square has no corners. And I haven't figured that line out yet, after 40 years of studying. The great vessel, could also be translated the great talent, takes the longest to complete or mature. Great music is without sound or sounds faint. Probably the latter. The great form has no shape. Tao is hidden and nameless, yet Tao alone nourishes and brings everything to perfection. This sounds very much like some things that H.P. Blavatsky says of the Absolute in The Secret Doctrine, which is why I think there is something profound in this book. And some of this is only just one instance of large numbers of paradoxical passages. Indeed, one of the chapters, 78, ends with this line, "Straightforward words seem paradoxical." Often Lao Tzu employs what sound like complete non sequiturs. And there's no apparent logical order to the chapters, yet he implies that there is a system to his thought. So what do you do with all of this? There have been over 40 translations into English, 3 by theosophists, despite the difficulty of translation and the terseness of the original. For instance, let me illustrate the difficulties in this with chapter 49. This is more or less a literal translation. Good man, I good him. Good in Chinese is shan. Good man, I good him. Not good man, I good him too. Now, good is being used as a verb. I mean, in terms of the order of the Chinese words, it's a verb. What does it mean? I consider him good. I treat him with goodness. I make him good. Or does Lao Tzu intend us to understand all three at the same time? And the next line in Chinese is der shan, which could mean power good, virtue good, or gets good. In other words, that is the virtue of goodness, that's the power of goodness, or that's the attainment of goodness. And this chapter ends with Hai Chir, which means grandchild's them, or grandchild's it. Grandchild's is being used as a verb. I have a translation of this later on, and I have an explanation of it. I don't know if it's true, but I have an explanation. And more famously, the book starts with this ambiguity. Dao ko dao, fei chang dao. Dao able, or can, or could, dao, used as a verb, not eternal dao. Now, the word dao is written with two Chinese elements, head over run. And thus, it could mean the way you go, the way the head goes. It could mean a path, as I'm suggesting, or a road. But it could also mean a method, a principle. And it is sometimes used in some context to mean reality. It can also mean go to see, explain, or tell of. See, it's very difficult to translate. So it could mean the way that can be told of is not the eternal way, which is the usual translation. In a marvelous book by Holmes Welch called Taoism, The Parting of the Way, which gave me real insight, I think, into this book. He says, some translators have concealed from their readers that neither they nor anyone else can be sure what Lao Tzu is talking about. Of the translators, of the translations into English, there have been a variety of approaches. C. Sturgeon Medhurst, Blakeney, and Lin Yutong have a Christian bias. Arthur Whaley and Wing Sit Chan are noted Confucian scholars, and I think sometimes miss the point. Zhang Chung Yuan takes an openly Heideggerian-based interpretation, and his translation makes no sense at all to me. But then, neither does Heidegger. D.C. Lau thinks the work is a compilation, so there is no need to find consistency in it, and yet his translation is a consistent one. Very interesting. Henry Wei, his translation is in the Quest Book series, construes it as a mystical meditation treatise, which I think is probably pretty close to correct. Giafu Feng has a wonderful translation, an aesthetic translation, and he doesn't see any sense in making it intelligible, so he doesn't. His translation is often unintelligible. Okay, Holmes Welch seems to have really got the idea, and he never did a translation. In fact, his book often quotes Arthur Whaley, which I think is a terrible translation. So, let me give some of the basic tenets of philosophical Taoism as I understand them. First, moral and political philosophy are inseparable from metaphysics. To be really effective, all political, social, or personal reform must be grounded in the way of nature, or it will only lead to further frustration. Confucius failed to see this, so Taoism is often radically different from Confucianism. In fact, there is one chapter which uses explicit Confucian terms, which suggests it must have been written after Confucius. So it was written after Confucius and before Confucius. Does that make sense? It doesn't make any sense to me. Maybe it was written by a number of different people who called themselves Lao Tzu. Maybe there was an old boys' school, a Laoist school, as one author puts it. And the head of the school was given the title Lao Tzu. It wasn't a proper name at all. That seems to me to make a little bit more sense. There it is. Anyway, chapter 32. The Tao way is forever nameless. Though its simplicity seems insignificant, none in the world can master it. If kings and lords would hold fast to it, the 10,000 things would spontaneously submit. Heaven and earth would unite and sweet dew would fall. The people unbidden would cooperate on their own. When discrimination began, names arose. As soon as there are names, know that it is time to stop. Knowing when to stop averts trouble. The way, Tao, in the world is like mountain rivulets flowing to the rivers and to the sea. Last line of chapter 55, whatever is contrary to the way will soon perish. I might have a footnote here. One of the concerns of later Confucian scholars was what they called rectification of names. They thought that language had somehow gotten confused and people didn't always know what they meant or didn't mean what they said, and there was confusion and so forth. So it was important to make sure everyone knew what a word meant. And Lao Tzu is saying, when you do that, you've gone wrong. See, there are lots of anti-Confucian things in here. Confucius is for the ordinary person in the world. Lao Tzu is for the spiritual seeker, the one on the path. I like Confucius. But I also like Lao Tzu. I fell in love with Lao Tzu in a course in undergraduate college, a course on world literature. No, it was on Asian literature. Asian literature. Japan, China, and India. I mean, it's an enormous corpus of literature there, one semester. And I decided to do a paper on Lao Tzu, on the Tao Te Ching. And so I got the Chinese, which I didn't know, and several translations, and I sat down and bumbled my way through and fell in love with it. And I've been in love with it ever since. Second principle, nature has a unitary principle acting through it, which Lao Tzu calls its way, Tao. There is a thing, amorphous yet complete, born before heaven and earth, silent and empty, abiding alone and unchanging, all-pervading, unfailing. It may be called the mother of the 10,000 things. 10,000 things is their word for everything in the universe. 100 families is all people. 10,000 things is everything. It may be called the mother of the 10,000 things. I do not know its name. I call it Tao. If forced to give it a name, I call it Da, great. Being great means outgoing or functioning everywhere. Functioning everywhere means far-reaching. Far-reaching means returning. Cycle, idea of cycles is inherent in Taoism. Therefore, Tao is great, heaven is great, earth is great, and man, or the king, is great. In the universe, there are four things that are great, and man, or the king, is one of them. Perhaps emperor would be another word in ancient China. Man follows earth, earth follows heaven, heaven follows Tao, and Tao follows what is natural, spontaneous. Another point, third, nature is impartial. It has no favorites. It obviously benefits the person who works with it rather than against it, but it is not, as Confucius wanted to call it, humane. This is the anti-Confucian passage, chapter 34. Heaven and earth are not humane. That was the cardinal Confucian virtue, Zhen. They regard the 10,000 things as straw dogs. I'll come back and explain that. The wise man is not Zhen, not humane. He regards the 100 families as straw dogs. The great Tao flows everywhere, both to the left and to the right. The 10,000 things depend on it for life. It holds nothing back. It accomplishes its purposes, yet claims no credit. Nature doesn't say, hey, look at that sunset, wasn't that great? It just does it, right? Claims no credit. It clothes and feeds the 10,000 things, but claims no lordship. Ever desireless, it may be called the small. When the 10,000 things return to it and it does not possess them, it may be called great. Because it does not show its greatness, it can accomplish great things. Now, let me explain straw dogs. In ancient China, there was a certain ceremony where they wove a certain image that looked like a dog from straw. And during the ceremony, during the ritual, it was treated with the utmost respect and reverence. And when the ceremony was over, it throws it away. It just threw it away. That's what nature does to material objects, isn't it? Think of the delicacy of a mosquito. I don't like mosquitoes. But have you ever noticed them? Incredible mechanisms, incredible, delicate little things. And when they're dead, it's all finished, done. We don't behave toward our bodies that way, do we? Well, theosophists do. They burn them, and, you know, they release the other components of our being from the physical body. But lots of people put them in a plantation, I mean a cemetery. As if somehow at the end of the day when Gabriel blows his horn, they're going to rise out of the grave. Now, think about this. Think about this. I mean, presumably God is going to have to flesh them out. And there's a wonderful story about, oh, I can't remember who wrote this, about two people who were buried next to one another, and worms had gotten at some of them and had eaten the eyeball of one of them. And this worm then pooped out, and the stuff was taken up into a tree and eventually made its way to an apple, which somebody else ate and gradually made into his eyeball. And so at the last trump, they're fighting over the eyeball. Whose eyeball? I mean, crying out loud. See, the idea behind this is that life in form is precious, but when you're done with it, you're done with it. That's the end. No sentimentality about it. Man departs from the natural way. Man behaves with partiality. And once he becomes partial, names things, makes distinctions, then one person benefits more than another. Envy arises, competition, and aggression. Holmes Welch calls this the law of aggression. And that, it seems to me, was when I read Holmes Welch and I saw this law of aggression, that gave me the insight into what Lao Tzu or what the Tao Te Ching was talking about. Chapter 46. When the way, Tao, prevails in the world, fast horses or raced horses are used for manure. When the way does not prevail in the world, war horses are bred in the suburbs. I'm reminded of a tank plant in Warren, Michigan, just north of Detroit, one of the suburbs. Those are our war horses. There is no greater calamity than covetousness. There is no greater misfortune than discontent. There is no greater disaster than greed. He who is content with contentment is always content. Makes a certain amount of sense, doesn't it? Aggression brings reprisal, so feeds on itself. Chapter 30. He who assists the ruler with the way does not dominate the world with arms. Such methods only bring reprisal. Where troops have encamped, briars and thorns grow. Where great armies have passed, bad harvests always follow. You can understand this in an agrarian society like ancient China, more than for us. But it's still true. In fact, Lao Tzu takes this as the basis of his teaching. Chapter 42 at the end. What others have taught, I also teach. Notice this. He doesn't say this is original with him. He's not making this up. He's just passing on an insight which he feels is ancient. What others have taught, I also teach. The violent and fierce man does not die a natural death. I shall make this the father or ancestor of my teaching. The law of aggression, then, is the starting point, and everything else centers around that. Once you see that, you can find the system behind this. This leads him to suggest a radical cure or path. In order to bring it home to us, he often uses unexpected analogies and startling proposals. This is why it seems paradoxical, as chapter 41 puts it. Perhaps this is also why Lao Tzu doesn't try to expound it systematically. All is interrelated, and he wants us to see that, to experience it, not to analyze, categorize, name, and forget it. That's what I did with a lot of my graduate courses, I'm afraid to say, and a lot of my undergraduate courses too. But that makes it very difficult to talk about. If my presentation seems a little confused, I can only say with Lao Tzu, chapter 81, the first half. 81 is the last of the chapters. True words are not beautiful. Beautiful words are not true. A good man does not argue. Those who argue are not good. A wise man is not widely learned. A widely learned man is not wise. I think that last line just condemned me. Okay, I agree. This leads him to a very radical suggestion, and it's called in Chinese wu wei, literally not do or not act. And in chapter 63, the first two lines are act without action, do without doing. And you say, what the heck does that mean? Perhaps this is a starting point for understanding Lao Tzu. Wu Wei, not doing, means not doing in a very special way. It means not acting aggressively. So the law of aggression is self-defeating in human relationships. The more you push someone, the more he resists and wants to push back, and then you push and then he pushes. Does this sound like Israel and the Arabs, the Palestinians? Does this sound like India and Pakistan? Does this sound like an awful lot of things going on in the world? Yeah. Chapter 42, it is often the case that things gain by losing and lose by gaining. Yeah. Therefore, if you hope to accomplish anything in human affairs, it must be by acting so as to attract people rather than to compel them. Did I bring that along? No, I didn't. Sidney Harris had a op-ed piece some years ago that I cut out, and he pointed out that Thomas Merton made this observation, that when you push people, when you order them to do things, they resist and they don't do them as well as if you sort of gain their cooperation. I haven't figured that one out yet. So this requires three things, according to Lao Tzu: compassion, frugality, and humility. Lao Tzu calls them his three treasures. And perhaps it is these that he carries like jade within his bosom. Chapter 67. There are three treasures which I guard and cherish. The first is compassion, Tzu. Tzu could also be translated deep love. The second is frugality, Qian. The third is humility, or another translation, not longing to be ahead of others, which is sort of humility with a lot of words. From compassion comes courage. From frugality comes generosity. It's very hard to give away something if you don't have it, right? From never wanting to be ahead comes leadership. Nowadays, men shun compassion yet try to be brave. They abandon frugality yet try to be generous. They forsake humility, try to be first. This is sure to end in death. For compassion brings victory in case of attack and protection and defense. What heaven is to save, it protects through compassion. As I say, the word I've translated compassion could also be translated deep love, Tzu. Compassion means to feel with, feeling with, and requires the ability to listen, to understand what is, to hear the meaning behind the words of others, to be open. Sounds like Krishnamurti, doesn't it? To see what is, constantly his phrase. Lao Tzu puts it this way: the wise man, or the sage, has no mind of his own. He regards the people's mind as his own. Those who are good, here comes that passage, those who are good I treat as good. Those who are not good I also treat as good. Thus goodness is attained. Those who are honest I treat as honest. Those who are not honest I also treat as honest. Thus honesty is attained. Or alternative translations. See, the trouble with the translation is you have to fix on one particular set of words when others could mean, I mean, could be just as plausible. The sage in the world has no subjective viewpoint. His mind forms a harmonious whole with the people. They all lend their eyes and ears, and he grandchilds them. What's the difference between the way a parent treats a child and a grandparent treats a child? Well, the grandparent can sort of, you know, be nice and friendly, then send them home to be disciplined. The parent has to do that. He grandchilds them. He doesn't treat them as little children, which is one of the translations. He treats them as grandchildren. Very different feeling. This non-dogmatic, non-doctrinaire openness is based upon the ability to still the mind, which many have likened to a Chinese system of yoga. And maybe this is one of its holdovers from religious Taoism. I don't know. Maybe. It's very difficult to tell because we don't have any real history of this stuff. This is chapter 16, the beginning. Empty yourself of everything. Hold firmly to stillness. Chapter 52, block the passages. Those are the senses. Shut the doors. Those are the action like mouth. Throughout your life, you will not be exhausted. Open the passages, meddle in affairs. Throughout your life, you will remain helpless. I guess that means me. Well, okay. But it is also a moral state of mind to Lao Tzu. And it is the only thing that works because it is the way of nature. Chapter 4. The way, Tao, is like emptiness. It may be used but is never exhausted. Fathomless, it seems the ancestor of the 10,000 things. It blunts its sharpness. It unties its tangles. It softens its glare. It becomes one with the dusty world. Deep and still, it appears to exist forever. And again, chapter 5, the last part. The space between heaven and earth is like a bellows. While empty, it is never exhausted. The more it moves, the more it yields. Much talk is quickly exhausted. Better keep to the center. I think I should stop. Only when you're empty can you be truly creative. Most people who are creative, and this applies to me too, will fall back on past and project the past into the future. And so they're not really being truly creative, novel, fresh. They're simply being mechanical. Krishnamurti talks a great deal about this too. Maybe Krishnamurti was a Taoist in his last life. I don't. Secondly, to avoid provoking resistance, one must be truly humble, not with an ostentatious humility that just irritates people. I mean, the Lucy Van Pelt school of humility. Remember that Peanuts cartoon where she says, "I'm the most humble person in the world. Nobody's more humble than me." Yeah, right. Spontaneous humility, of which you are not even aware yourself. Chapter 7. Heaven and earth are everlasting. Why are heaven and earth everlasting? Because they do not exist for themselves. That's why they're everlasting. Therefore, the wise man stays in the background. Thus he gets pushed to the front. He's indifferent to himself. Thus he is preserved. Is it not because he is selfless that he attains fulfillment? Finally, to avoid provoking resistance and thus aggression, one must not do anything which would evoke envy or greed. One must lead a simple, frugal life. Boy, that's anti-American. I better not let the president hear this. Put me in prison or down in Guantanamo or something. In guiding people and serving heaven, there is nothing better than frugality. This is chapter 59. Only by being frugal can one recover quickly. To recover quickly means to accumulate virtue, richly. Accumulating virtue richly, one can deal with everything. When one can deal with everything, no one knows his limits. When no one knows his limits, he is fit to rule a state. He who possesses this mother of the state will long endure. This is called having deep roots and firm stems, which is the way, the Tao, of long life and eternal vision. In order to accomplish this latter, Lao Tzu offers one of his most radical proposals: do away with distinctions. My favorite chapter, chapter 2. When all under heaven know beauty as beauty, there arises the recognition of ugliness. Beauty is in contrast, isn't it? When all know the good is the good, there arises the recognition of evil. Therefore, having and not having produce each other. They're twin concepts, right? Difficult and easy complement each other. Long and short contrast each other. High and low distinguish each other. Sound and voice harmonize each other. That is to say, the voice and the accompaniment. Front and back accompany each other. Have you ever seen something that's all front and no back? Oh, there's a person who used to go down to the Bahamas, and take his camera down into the water and stay in one place. Because he said, if you like this, you're like a shark, and the fish stay away from you. But if you stand up this way, they don't see you as a predator. So he set his camera up, and he saw this little, what was it, goby or guppy or something, some little fish that buries itself in the sand and puts stones around it. And one time he put a mirror up, and the fish saw another of its kind, and it was muscling in on its territory, and he wanted to get rid of it. So he ran around behind, and it disappeared. He came around the front, whoop, there it is again. It's the funniest thing. A mirror has only front, doesn't it? Well, it does have a back. It doesn't shine, but a mirror image is one-faced. But, you know, front and back accompany each other. So he draws this conclusion. This is the first half of chapter 36. What is to contract must first be stretched. What is to be weakened must first be strengthened. What is to be cast down must first be exalted or raised up. What is to be taken away must first be given. Back to chapter 2. Therefore, the wise man manages affairs without action, wu wei, not do. Teaches without words, by example, presumably. The 10,000 things arise and fall ceaselessly. He produces them, but does not possess them. He acts, but takes no credit. He completes his task, and then forgets it. It is because he takes no credit that his achievements last forever. And this leads to another aspect of wu wei, non-action, which Welch terms the law of opposites. Aggression is cyclic, just like nature. So, if one wishes to stop aggression, one must do two things. Do away with distinctions, we've already seen that, and meet force with weakness. In a kind of moral judo, which in Chinese is ru dao, the way of yielding. But you have to yield in a certain way. Because if people perceive you as a weakling, they take advantage of you. So you have to yield in a way that the action coming against you throws itself. And the person says, that didn't work, I've got to try something else. To yield is to be preserved whole. To be bent is to become straight. To be empty is to be full. To be worn out is to be renewed. To have little is to possess. To have much is to be confused. Therefore, the wise man embraces the one and becomes a model for the world. He does not show himself, therefore he is conspicuous. He does not assert himself, therefore he is prominent. He does not boast of himself, therefore he is given credit. He does not brag, therefore he can long endure. It is because he does not compete that the world cannot compete with him. Therefore the ancients say, yield and overcome. Is that an empty saying? Truly, it enables one to be preserved to the end. And then the last part of 36. This is called the subtle wisdom or subtle light, the soft and weak overcome the hard and strong. Another place he says, a woman gets control of her husband by taking the lower part and makes him think that he's getting his way. As fish must not leave deep waters, so the state's sharp weapons must not be displayed to the people. And this leads to this very anti-Confucian passage. Do not exalt the gifted, which is very Confucian, exalt the gifted. The people will not compete. Do not value treasures. People will not steal. I mean, it's hard to steal something if you don't possess it in the first place, right? Do not display desirable things, and people's hearts will not be confused. And again, the anti-Confucian passage, chapter 19. Abandon sageliness, Confucian virtue. Discard wisdom, another Confucian virtue. And the people will benefit a hundredfold. Abandon humaneness, Ren, the cardinal Confucian virtue. Discard righteousness, Yi, another Confucian virtue. The people will return to filial piety and deep love or compassion, Zu. Abandon cleverness, discard profit. There'll be no more thieves and robbers. But these three are only ornaments and not enough. Therefore, let the people hold on to these. Manifest plainness, literally in Chinese, su, raw silk, that is to say, before it was dyed or before something was painted on it. In other words, it had infinite potential. When you paint on it, it can only be that one thing, right? Manifest plainness. Embrace simplicity. Pu, in Chinese, literally uncarved wood, the uncarved block, which, again, has infinite potential. Once you carve it, it's just what it is and nothing else. Cast off selfishness. Have few desires. Nothing is softer or more yielding than water, yet nothing is better for attacking the hard and strong. For this reason, there's no substitute for it. Water is a very interesting metaphor. I mean, it's needed for life. It nourishes life. It's the major portion of our body. And yet, little by little, it wears away hard substances like rocks and so forth. And when it freezes, it cracks them, as happens to our highways in the winter, which is why they have to be patched. The highest good is like water. Water benefits the 10,000 things, but does not compete with them. It rests in places men reject. That is why it is like the Tao. Now, there's a lot more that one could say about this remarkable book. So I'm going to cut it short at this point and see if I can find the ending to my talk. There is a passage that sort of mentions in passing the Chinese concept of qi, which I think means the same thing as Sanskrit prana, but I can't prove that. A qi has two aspects, a yang aspect, heaven aspect, and a yin or earthly aspect. Both are equally important. It's not that heaven is better than earth or earth better than heaven. And the balance of these contributes to health. And so when carrying your hun and po, these are the two aspects of the Chinese think are the soul, can you embrace the one and not let go? When concentrating your qi, can you become as supple as a baby? When polishing and purifying your mysterious mirror, can you leave no blemish? What's that? The mind? I don't know. When loving the people and ruling the state, can you do so without knowledge? Now, there's one passage in the Tao Te Ching that gives me trouble. And I think I have it all figured out until I read chapter 80. And this is it. Let a state be small with few people. Very un-American. Very un-Chinese. Though there are contrivances that can work 10 or 100 times faster than man, they're not used. Very un-American. The people take death seriously and do not travel far. Very un-American. Though there are boats and carriages, no one uses them. I used one to come over here. Though there are armor and weapons, no one displays them. Yeah. Let man return to knotting ropes. That was used in place of writing. The ancient Incans also used a system like that. Let them be satisfied with their food, pleased with their clothing, content with their homes, delighted with their customs. Though adjoining states are within sight of one another, and the crowing of cocks and barking of dogs may be overheard, yet the people grow old and die without ever visiting one another. What? Lao Tzu's ideal society seems to be one in which one is ignorant, fat, dumb, and happy. And clearly that is not the theosophical goal for humanity. Furthermore, how can one build a brotherhood of humanity, the first object of the theosophical society, if one never comes into contact with people from other countries and cultures? Perhaps I'm missing something in Lao Tzu's recommendation here. Perhaps this is a later addition to the text by someone who misinterpreted Lao Tzu's ideas as escapist. But whatever this passage may mean, and I think it has a deeper significance, the rest is what I'm going to hang on to. And I'll just kind of forget this passage until I can figure it out. I do hope that I have been able to share with you some of the enthusiasm I have for this marvelous text and what I consider the way of Lao Tzu. Thank you.